This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne, Chapter 14, in which Phileas Fogg descends the whole length of the beautiful valley of the Ganges without ever thinking of seeing it. The rash exploit had been accomplished, and for an hour Passepartout laughed gaily at his successes. Sir Francis pressed the worthy fellow's hand, and his master said, "Well done," which from him was high commendation, at which Passepartout replied that all the credit of the affair belonged to Mr. Fogg. As for him, he had only been struck with a queer idea, and he laughed to think that for a few moments he, Passepartout, the ex-gymnast, ex-surgeon, Firmin, had been the spouse of a charming woman, a venerable, embalmed Raja. As for the young Indian woman, she had been unconscious throughout of what was passing, and now, wrapped up in a traveling blanket, was reposing in one of the howdahs. The elephant, thanks to the skillful guidance of the Parsi, was advancing rapidly through the still darksome forest, and an hour after leaving the pagoda had crossed a vast plain. They made a halt at 7 o'clock, the young woman being still in a state of complete prostration. The guide made her drink a little brandy and water, but the drowsiness which stupefied her could not yet be shaken off. Sir Francis, who was familiar with the effects of the intoxication produced by the fumes of hemp, reassured his companions on her account, but he was more disturbed at the prospect of her future fate. He told Phileas Fogg that, should Ilda remain in India, she would invariably fall again into the hands of her executioners. These fanatics were scattered throughout the country and would, despite the English policy, recover their victim at Madras, Bombay, or Calcutta. She would only be safe by quitting India forever. Phileas Fogg replied that he would reflect upon the matter. The station at Allahabad was reached at about 10 o'clock, and the interrupted line of railway being resumed would enable them to reach Calcutta in less than 24 hours. Phileas Fogg would thus be able to arrive in time to take the steamer, which left Calcutta the next day, October 25th at noon, for Hong Kong. The young woman was placed in one of the waiting rooms of the station, whilst Passepartout was charged with purchasing for her various articles of toilet, a dress, shawl, and some furs, for which his master gave him unlimited credit. Passepartout started off forthwith and found himself in the streets of Allahabad, that is, the City of God, one of the most venerated in India, being built at the junction of the two sacred rivers, Ganges and Jumna, the waters of which attract pilgrims from every part of the peninsula. The Ganges, according to the legends of the Ramayan, rises in heaven, whence, owing to Brahma's agency, it descends to earth. Passepartout made it a point, as he made his purchases, to take a good look at the city. It was formerly defended by a noble fort, which has since become a state prison. Its commerce has dwindled away, and Passepartout in vain looked about him for such a bazaar as he used to frequent in Regent Street. At least he came upon an elderly, crusty Jew who sold second-hand articles, and from whom he purchased a dress of Scotch stuff, a large mantle, and fine otter-skin pelisse, for which he did not hassle to pay £75. He then returned triumphantly to the station. The influence to which the priests of Pelagie had subject Aelda began gradually to yield, and she became more herself, so that her fine eyes resumed all their soft Indian expression. When the poet king Ukaf Udal celebrated the charms of the queen of Amehegre, he speaks thus: her shining tresses, divided in two parts, encircled the harmonious counter of her white and delicious cheeks, brilliant in their glow and freshness. Her aboy brings how the firm and charm of the bow of Kama, the god of love, and beneath her long silken lashes, the purest reflection and a celestial light swim as the sacred lakes of Himalaya in the black pupils of her great clear eyes. Her teeth, fine, equal, and white, glittered between her smiling lips like dewdrops, and a passion flower's half-enveloped breast. Her delicately foamed ears, her vermilion hands, her little feet, carved and tender as the lotus bud, glitter with the brilliancy of the loveliest pearls of Ceylon, the most dazzling diamonds of Calcutta. Her narrow and supple waist, which a hand may clasp around, sets forth the outlines of her rounded figure and the beauty of her bosom, which youth in its flowers displays the wealth of its treasures. And beneath the silken folds of her tunic, she seems to have been modeled in pure silver by the godlike hand of Vikvarkama, the immortal sculptor. It is enough to say, without applying this poetic rapacity to Aelda, that she was a charming woman in all the European acceptation of the phrase. She spoke English with great purity, and the guide had not exaggerated in saying that the young Parsi had been transformed by her bringing up. The train was about to start from Allahabad, and Mr. Fogg proceeded to pay the guide the price agreed upon for his service, and not a farthing more, which astonished Passepartout, who remembered all that his master owed to the guide's devotion. He had, indeed, risked his life in the adventure of Pijah, and if he should be caught afterwards by the Indians, he would with difficulty escape their vengeance. Quani also must be disposed of. What should be done with the elephant, which had been so dearly purchased? Phileas Fogg had already determined this question. "Parsi," said he to the guide, "you have been serviceable and devoted. I have paid you for your service, but not for your devotion. Would you like to have this elephant? He is yours." The guide's eyes glistened. "Your honor is giving me a fortune," cried he. "Take him, guide," returned Mr. Fogg, "and I shall still be your debtor." "Good," exclaimed Passepartout. "Take him, friend. Quani is a brave and faithful beast." And going up to the elephant, he gave him several lumps of sugar, saying, "Here, Quani, here, here." The elephant grunted out his satisfaction, and clasping Passepartout around the waist with his trunk, lifted him as high as his head. Passepartout, not in the least alarmed, caressed the animal, which replaced him gently on the ground. Soon after, Phileas Fogg, Sir Francis Cromarty, and Passepartout installed in a carriage with Aelda, who had the best seat, were whirling at full speed towards Benares. It was a run of 80 miles and was accomplished in 2 hours. During the journey, the young woman fully recovered her senses. What was her astonishment to find herself in this carriage on the railway, dressed in European habiliments, and with travelers who were quite strangers to her. Her companions first set about fully recovering her with a little liquor, and then Sir Francis narrated to her what had passed. Dwelling upon the courage with which Phileas Fogg had not hastened to risk his life to save her, and recounting that happy sequel of the venture that resulted of Passepartout's rash idea, Mr. Fogg said nothing, while Passepartout, abashed, kept repeating that it wasn't worth telling. Hilda pathetically thanked her deliverers, rather with tears than words. Her fine eyes interpreted her gratitude better than her lips. Then, as her thoughts strayed back to the scene of the sacrifice and recalled the dangers which still menaced her, she shuddered with terror. Phileas Fogg understood what was passing in Aoda's mind and offered, in order to reassure her, to escort her to Kong Kong, where she might remain safely until the affair was hushed up, an offer which she eagerly and gratefully accepted. She had, it seems, a Parsi relation, who was one of the principal merchants of Hong Kong, which is wholly an English city, though on an island on the Chinese coast. At 12:30, train stopped at Berners. The Brahmin legends asserted that this city is built on the site of the ancient Kasi, which, like Mahomet's tomb, was once suspended between heaven and earth, though the Benares of today, which the Orientalists call the Athens of India, stands quite unpoetically on the solid earth. Passepartout caught glimpses of its brick houses and clay huts, giving an aspect of desolation to the place as the train entered it. Benares was Sir Francis Cromarty's destination, the troops he was rejoining being encamped some miles northward of the city. He bade adieu to Phileas Fogg, wishing him all success, and expressing the hope that he would come that way again, in less original but more profitable fashion. Mr. Fogg lightly pressed him by the hand. The parting of Aoda, who did not forget what she owed to Sir Francis, betrayed more warmth, and as for Passepartout, he received a hearty shake of the hand from the gallant general. The railway, on leaving Benares, passed for a while along the valley of Ganges. Throughout the window of the carriage, the traveler had glimpses of the diversified landscape of Bahar, which, its mountains clothed in verdure, its fields of barley, wheat, and corn, its jungles, people with green alligators, its neat villages, and its still thicky-leaved forests. Elephants were bathing in the waters of the sacred river, and groups of Indians, despite advanced sessions and chilly air, were performing solemnly their poyas ablutions. These were fervent Brahmins, the bitterest foes of Buddhism, their duties being Vishnu, the solar god, Shiva, and divine impersonation of natural forces, and Brahma, the supreme ruler of priests and legislators. What would these divinities think of India, Anglicist as it is today, with steamers, whistles, and scooting along the Ganges, frightened the gulls which float upon its surface, the turtles swimming along its banks, and the faithful dwelling upon its borders? The phenomena passed before their eyes like a flash, save when the steam concealed it fully from view. The travelers could scarcely discern the fort of Trupani 20 miles southwestward from Benares, the ancient stronghold of the Rajas of Mehor, of Ghazipur, and its famous rosewater factories, or the tomb of Lord Cromwell's, rising on the left bank of the Ganges, the fortified town of Buxar and Panta, a large manufacturing and trading place. where is held the principal opium market of India, on Mogere, a more than European town, for it is English as merchants of bringers with its iron foundries, egg toll factories, and high chimneys putting clouds of black smoke heavenward. Night came on, the train passed on at full speed in the midst of the roaring of the tigers, bears, and wolves, which fled before the locomotive and the marvels of Bengal, Golconda, Runingor, Marshabad, the ancient capital, Baldwin, Hooghly, and the French town of Chengagor, where Passepartout would have been proud to see his country's flag flying, were hidden from view in the darkness. Kolkata was reached at 7 in the morning, and the packet left for Hong Kong at noon, so that Phileas Fogg had 5 hours before him. According to his journal, he was due at Calcutta on the 25th of October, and that was the exact date of his actual arrival. He was, therefore, neither behindhand nor ahead of time. The 2 days gained between London and Bombay had been lost, as has been seen in the journey across India. But it is not to be surprised that Phileas Fogg regretted them. End of chapter 14. This has been a TBOL3 production.